12. The Geography of Thought. Do you put the well-being of your community before your own happiness? For decades, sociologists have been puzzled by a marked contrast in how different parts of the world answer that question. People living in North America and Europe are more likely to see themselves as free agents responsible for their own personal happiness and success, a mindset epitomized by the Western United States' reverence for rugged individualism. In contrast, large swaths of the East, notably India, Pakistan, and China, place a high value on collectivism, and group cohesion and harmony take precedence over individual aspirations. This attitude is by no means limited to Asia, however. Equatorial regions of South America and Africa rank highest of all on a standardized questionnaire measuring collectivist attitudes. Where a society falls on the collectivism versus individualism spectrum, in turn, correlates with a host of other traits, from religious values and political views to attitudes toward strangers. In 2007, Randy Thornhill, a biologist at the University of New Mexico, and his graduate student, Corey Fincher, pondered the origins of this powerful cultural divide. Over the years, social scientists had put forward a hodgepodge of theories to explain it, many focusing on historical idiosyncrasies, economic development, and means of livelihood. But the biologists found these explanations lacking. None accounted for why the myriad traits defining each cultural perspective clustered together in the first place. That got them thinking, Fincher said. Can we explain personality and attitudes based on natural selection or evolutionary history? What aspects of an environment might promote different personalities? The concentration of collectivist cultures near the equator, a parasitic hot zone, caught their attention. Our vulnerability to infection, they observed, shapes a number of aspects of culture. How spicy people like their food, for example, and the degree to which they prize a mate's beauty, which in large part is a marker of a strong immune system. If parasites can influence our customs and aesthetics, they reasoned, perhaps they can shape our temperament and values as well. As they prepared to test their hunch, unbeknownst to them, another group of investigators was proceeding on a parallel front, prompted by a different line of reasoning. That team was headed by someone we've already met, Canadian psychologist Mark Schaller, who'd found that people become more prejudiced toward foreigners when shown pictures that called to mind the threat of infectious disease. Other psychologists, following his lead, had shown that subjects become more reticent and less sexually adventurous when primed to think of germs. Inspired by these observations, Schaller and colleague Damian Murray set out to explore whether these brief, lab-induced shifts in disposition might become long-lasting traits in places where parasitic illness was an everyday threat. To help them in that task, they were able to tap into two newly available databases created by large cadres of scientists working for the International Sexuality Description Project, and a separate initiative, the Personality Profiles of Cultures Project. By superimposing this data onto old disease atlases, Schaller and Murray uncovered a fascinating pattern, one that dovetailed beautifully with experimental findings. In areas that have historically endured a high incidence of infection, people are more likely to be introverted and less prone to seek out novel experiences. Women, and to a lesser extent, men in these regions, also report having restricted sexual lifestyles. That is, they have fewer partners over their lifespans and believe sex should be reserved for stable, committed relationships. In short, they don't mingle readily and they tend to follow traditional codes of conduct that might serve as a buffer against disease. For example, washing before prayer, bowing instead of shaking hands, and marrying only within their religious groups. Their traits, Schaller and Murray realized, seemed to be a part of a broader package of values, namely collectivism. An adherence to convention and distrust of foreign ways of doing things are well-known characteristics of collectivist societies. Could disease avoidance be an overlooked function of that belief system? As they turned to test that theory, they received a call from Thornhill, who'd just heard about their work from a colleague who'd attended a recent conference where they'd presented their findings. Thornhill and his graduate student were doing the same kind of research and thinking along very similar lines. Would they like to join forces? I was shocked, said Schaller. This is messy stuff to do and also kind of wacky. Yet here was a group working essentially in the same territory. Still more remarkable, their approaches appeared to be highly compatible. They were coming from the perspective of ecologists, and they knew a lot about the spread of diseases. We were approaching this topic from the perspective of psychologists who knew how pathogens affect behavior. What's more, each group had developed complementary measures for assessing the prevalence of infectious disease. Thornhill and Fincher had compiled data on 98 countries from contemporary sources such as the Global Infectious Diseases and Epidemiology Network. Schaller and Murray had combed through old medical atlases to assess where infectious disease had been highest in the past. If they collaborated, they would be able to test their theories on both datasets. A big bonus, as historic levels of disease should more strongly correlate with collectivism than present-day figures, assuming a region's health was driving its value system, as they were proposing. The results suggested their wacky idea might not be so wacky after all. High levels of infectious disease were a remarkably powerful predictor of collectivism. And just as they'd theorized, the association was strongest of all for regions that had historically been burdened by heavy parasite loads. The association held up even after they substantially controlled for variables such as poverty, population density, and life expectancy. We're not saying, cautioned Fincher, every individual in the U.S. is individualistic or everyone in China is collectivistic. There's tremendous variation within any given population on these traits. We're just talking about relative prevalence, mean or average values, where you'll see differences between nations. The researchers dubbed their theory the parasite stress model of sociality, and two of the scientists, Fincher and Thornhill, soon went on to examine whether the pattern they'd detected on an international scale held up within the United States. Sure enough, they found that Americans were the most collectivistic in the very states, mostly in the Deep South, where Centers for Disease Control and Prevention figures indicated infectious disease was highest. Thornhill, who grew up in Alabama in the 40s, was not surprised to learn Southerners had unusually tight family bonds and made a big distinction between them and us. In the early decades of the 20th century, Southerners were considered far less productive than Northerners, a sluggishness that was eventually traced to epidemic levels of hookworm that had rendered a large sector of the population anemic. The South in that era was also plagued by malaria, a problem that required the draining of swamps and other major efforts to bring it under control. He believes those combined factors may explain why the region even today remains more clannish than the rest of the country. The vestiges of this ethnocentrism, he said, is even reflected in the way people speak. Y'all was invented in the American South in the 18th century. It's not a contraction of you and all. Today, it may be used that way, but it was originally a linguistic tool for addressing the persons in group, extended families and close friends. When languages drop first and second person pronouns, I and you, they're likely to be collectivist cultures. Individualist cultures talk about I a lot. The measure is crude, but it's considered valid across countries of the world. The notion that a single phenomenon, our species' psychological adaptation to parasite stress, can shape entire cultures may sound simplistic, but plenty of scientists are open to the theory. Cornell psychologist David Pizarro counts among them. I love their work, he said. I think this is the right way of approaching the topic. Steven Pinker, the evolutionary psychologist and author of such best-selling books as The Blank Slate and The Better Angels of Our Nature, echoed his sentiment. I think the theory is well worth pursuing. Of course, it has attracted flack, too. The most common criticism being that a correlation between parasite stress and collectivism does not prove that one caused the other, especially with something as complex and multifaceted as culture. It can be very tricky to control for unrecognized factors that might be behind the association. The theory's progenitors are well aware of that hazard, and though there's no simple solution to the problem, they have found ways to subject their ideas to more rigorous scrutiny. Based on their model, for example, they've generated numerous new predictions and tested them against voluminous bodies of data gathered from many different sectors of the social sciences. So far, they report, their theory has held up well to this barrage of tests. Not only that, but their latest findings lead them to think its explanatory powers are considerably broader than they'd initially proposed. Do you live in a democracy or under a brutal dictatorship? Are you deeply religious? Do women in your country have the same rights as men? Is war frequently erupting around you? Thornhill and Fincher believe parasite stress has direct bearing on all those questions. The scientists have buttressed their theory not just by crunching numbers, but also by reviewing findings from field studies. These studies show that parasites are finicky creatures, rather like orchids in a hothouse. Especially in the tropics, they thrive best within narrow ranges of temperature and humidity. Scattered in pockets across Peru and Bolivia, for example, are 124 genetically distinct strains of the human parasite Leishmania brasiliensis. People in those regions are well adapted to coexisting with only some of those strains. So if they move very far away from their own locale, they may encounter novel strains that could sicken or kill them. If a foreigner were to insinuate himself into their group, his germs could be lethal to them and vice versa. That foreigner's genes, should one of them decide to mate with him, would produce children whose immune systems would be less adept at fighting off local scourges. For these reasons, Thornhill and Fincher theorize, people in parasitic hot zones should be reluctant to marry outside their own community, and they should develop all kinds of idiosyncratic markers of communal identity. Unique dialects, religious practices, culinary customs, modes of dress, jewelry, music, and so forth, that allow each group to tell them from us. In short, the theory predicts that regions teeming with parasites should produce homebodies and a balkanized social landscape, that is, divided by religions and languages, among other social barriers. Indeed, that's what they found. They also discovered that people in these zones are more fervent about their faith, as measured by the number of times they pray per week, how often they attend services, and many other indices tracked by ethnographers. Atheism, by contrast, flourishes where there are very low parasite loads. Religious scholars, said Thornhill, have been very interested in religious commitment, but they can't predict which countries will be religious-based on current paradigms. Their theories are not very sophisticated. For example, you learn your religion from your parents. In contrast, he and Fincher found, epidemiological data is a very good indicator of where religious fervor will burn brightest. And the more baroque a religion's sacred rituals, and the greater the demands on its adherents, the better it is at keeping the congregation tightly bound together and separate from the members of other sects and their parasites. Thornhill and Fincher, convinced their theory might have still broader applicability, reasoned that in parasitic hot zones, pressure to follow sexual and hygiene-related practices might breed intolerance toward those who buck conventions. Traditions are sacred and must be strictly enforced, creating hierarchical societies. People get used to abiding by rules and bowing to authority, and they become less accepting of dissent. The very conditions that might be favorable for the establishment of repressive regimes. To test their hypothesis, the scientists accessed the Democracy Index, the Human Freedom Index, and other publicly available scales that rank countries on a spectrum from democratic to autocratic, based on measures such as voter participation, civil liberties, wealth distribution, and gender equality. Again, the results supported their theory. Countries under severe parasite stress were more likely to be controlled by dictators. Gender inequality was pronounced, and wealth tended to be concentrated in the hands of a small class of elites. In contrast, countries with the least amount of infectious disease had wealth more equitably distributed. Their women were on a more equal footing with men, and individual rights were far more extensive. They were overwhelmingly democracies. If we are to believe Thornhill and Fincher, parasite stress breeds a distrust of outsiders that contributes to homicides, civil strife, and the division of society by race and class. Almost everywhere they looked, they uncovered evidence supporting their theory. Who would have thought that parasites would relate to collectivism, personality traits, political beliefs, religiosity, and civil strife? If our theory only worked for collectivism and individualism, that would be cool, but it wouldn't suggest that we're onto something big and important. By scientific standards, Thornhill has a swashbuckling style. The biologist, whose many accomplishments include important work early in his career on the mating behavior of insects, is known as an academic cowboy, someone not afraid to take on controversial subjects. That has occasionally gotten him into trouble. In 2000, he ignited a firestorm with the publication of a book, A Natural History of Rape, that he co-authored with the anthropologist Craig T. Palmer. In it, they argued that rape was best understood in an evolutionary context and challenged the notion that the crime was never sexually motivated. That did not go over well with those who believed it to be purely an act of aggression, and who took Thornhill and Palmer's position as a justification for an inexcusable crime, as in, "Your Honor, my genes made me do it." That was not what the researchers meant, which they took great pains to explain during appearances on the Today Show and an array of news programs. But in the ensuing uproar, Thornhill received numerous death threats, and during the worst of the maelstrom, he had to be escorted around his campus by the university police. The parasite stress theory has yet to leap into public awareness, so at least for now, disputes about it remain low-key and within academia. "I haven't gotten any death threats against me for it yet," he said. But his penchant for making bold statements with few qualifiers suggests he's still game to play the role of provocateur, for better or worse. Schaller and Murray have adopted a more cautious tone. Schaller speaks of having creeping confidence in aspects of the model, and they have focused their research more narrowly in the areas where they have the greatest expertise. As Schaller told me, religion and civil war are outside his bailiwick. While he's intrigued by the many directions in which Thornhill and Fincher's work is leading, he has the strongest trust in the data he and Murray have been most engaged in collecting and analyzing, which pertains to authoritarianism. They've investigated its link to parasite stress using a different approach than Thornhill and Fincher. Instead of doing a country-by-country analysis, they focused on 90 small-scale societies that are culturally very distinct to guard against the potential bias of regions having a shared history. For example, nations may be democracies not because they have a low incidence of infectious disease, but because their populaces are largely derived from Europe and they've imported its system of values. Would pathogen prevalence still predict autocratic governance among societies with almost no shared history? The answer, they found, is yes. They also conducted another study that relied on a more concrete measure of authoritarianism than a paper test. They looked at how many people in a society are right-handed. Their logic being that cultures intolerant of individuality would pressure people who are naturally left-handed to use their right hands. If high rates of infection promote authoritarian values, they reasoned, parasitic hot zones should have more right-handers. That's exactly what they found. Value systems may have costs and benefits that vary depending on the prevalence of pathogens, said Schaller. The cost of being a maverick, what we in the West call being a rugged individualist, might outweigh benefits in places where pathogens are abundant, whereas the reverse might hold true where pathogens are scarce. In that world, he said, doing things differently, thinking outside the box, is more likely to be valued, as it spurs creativity and technological innovation. Although there are now, in Schaller's words, a lot of different pieces of evidence linking pathogen prevalence to various kinds of cultural differences, he cautioned that parasite stress clearly is not the only thing that plays a role in shaping society. If there's one thing we know in cognitive behavioral sciences, it's this. Everything is multi-determined. In his view, for example, it would be grossly simplistic to conclude that religion is simply a parasite defense, even if that's a function it serves. And that's a big if for now, he emphasized. That in no way implies that religion arose to serve that purpose alone, or that it continues to exist for that one reason. Similarly, linguistic diversity, types of governance, and outbreaks of violence are no doubt the products of numerous geographic and historical factors, not parasite stress alone. For an in-depth analysis of such factors, readers may wish to consult Jared Diamond's Pulitzer Prize-winning book, Guns, Germs, and Steel. The big challenge, said Schaller, will be to figure out how all these variables combine, which he suspects could take many years to work out. How parasite stress gets translated into attitudes and personality traits will also need to be clarified. Schaller speculated that there may have been differential selection for different personality traits in different cultures. There may be different frequencies of alleles, gene variants, for neurotransmitter pathways related to mood and temperament. This is an area where we want to tread cautiously. My collaborators and I are a bunch of white guys, and we're saying Europeans are more open-minded and adventurous. It sounds so horribly self-serving. We know how incredibly complicated the genes and environment interaction is. For example, he and his collaborators theorize that having one's disgust button pressed often during childhood may up or down regulate genes associated with temperament or risk aversion. Obviously, people learn practices in their culture that guard against infection. Individual life experiences, for instance, witnessing all of one's siblings die of disease in childhood, could also make people hypervigilant about germs. The causal pathway could be still more complicated. The brain may sense when the immune system is in overdrive due to chronic infections, Fincher speculates, and in response, switch an individual's mental outlook into a defensive mode manifested by collectivistic thinking. Thornhill suspects humans may even have evolved the ability to read levels of antibodies circulating in other people's blood, which would tell them whether those around them were harboring lots of parasites. Are you talking about a sixth sense? I asked him. There could be 7 to 500 senses that allow the brain to detect antibody titers and the duration of immune system activation, he replied. When you look at a person, you're assessing information about their age, all the hormone markers, the symmetry of the face and movement of the person. All this stuff ties to the health stats of an individual. Body odor might also provide information about a person's immune status. There could be multiple things the brain is reading. While the architects of the parasite stress model wrestle with the mechanisms that might explain their findings, other scientists are scrutinizing fundamental assumptions that underpin it, such as the assertion that bunching up into small insular groups, the technical term for this is assortative sociality, helps to thwart the spread of disease. A smattering of animal evidence and computer models by population geneticists support the idea. But scientists caution these models are only as good as the data that's fed into them and are still quite crude. Evolutionary psychologist Dan Fessler points out that human groups almost always trade with one another, something animals don't do, which could undermine claims for the theory. Cultural anthropologists have begun to weigh in with their own opinions, and while facets of the model seem feasible to many of them, they also find flaws in its logic. For example, anthropologist Richard Sosis and colleagues at the University of Connecticut point out that proselytizers regularly come into contact with strangers, and some religious practices, such as ritual bloodletting, promote rather than impede the transmission of disease. Although no theory, especially not one that purports to account for cultural variation, can always make spot-on predictions, these counterexamples still raise troubling questions, and if enough of them accumulate, the theory could crumble under their weight. Its proponents might also be accused of having a political axe to grind, as the model could easily be construed as being anti-religion and an across-the-board indictment of collectivism, which corresponds closely to conservative values. Certainly, those who hold views on the right-leaning end of the spectrum might understandably question the researcher's impartiality. In short, the model is controversial, and I suspect will only become more so should the debate over its merits spill into the public arena. Thornhill, for his part, isn't worried about whose feathers he might ruffle or whether the model will stand up to scrutiny. "So far, the evidence that we're wrong is wrong," he said with a good-humored twinkle. "And if you're right," I asked him, "how does it change things?" "If we're right, then the implication for saving the world is reducing parasite stress. Focus there. A lot of people would say we've got to build schools. Another group would say we have to build economic institutions in these countries to make them better. Our data and ideas say, fundamentally, that you work on the non-zoonotic diseases, illnesses transmitted from person to person. And then, in due time, when these kids are raised in better environments in terms of disease, then you'll get more liberal-minded kids. You're going to get economic productivity because there won't be as many social barriers. There's more exchange of ideas. You're going to get interest in education, and then you're going to save the world." When I pressed Thornhill to point to a country that exemplifies his philosophy, he shot back, "The whole of the Western world, because gradually there's been a reduction in infectious disease. In the 1920s, you get chlorinated water. By the 1930s, you have food handling and sanitation laws. These spread very rapidly, specifically in the West, but not outside the West. Around the same time, you got antibiotics. By 1945, you got fluorinated water, and it spread very rapidly. That knocked out all the mouth infections. In 1945, you also got DDT, which knocked out all the insect vectors of disease. Malaria went down the drain, and so did other human diseases spread by insects. In the 1960s, we got the Cultural Revolution, civil rights, women's rights, the sexual revolution. All that stuff came out of the cleanup of infectious diseases, specifically in the West, liberal parts of the world. Outside of the West, none of these things have occurred." No doubt many might challenge that provocative slant on history. But if we accept his premise, then we'd be wise to re-examine geopolitical objectives with parasite stress in mind. As Ebola's devastating rampage through West Africa brought into sharp relief, much of the developing world still does not have even the most rudimentary medical infrastructure. Vast populations in parasitic hot zones are without hospitals, doctors, drugs, or surgical equipment. Meanwhile, often directed at the very same underserved regions, wealthy countries are throwing billions of dollars into campaigns aimed at containing wars ignited by ethnic hatred and religious intolerance, not to mention dealing with the refugee crises and other tragedies this violence has spawned. By investing more in healthcare up front, Thornhill's model predicts, Western countries might not have to spend so much on warfare later, and may ultimately reduce human suffering far more effectively. A group of ethicists at Oxford University, led by Russell Powell, agree that the parasite stress theory could potentially change how wealthier nations make foreign policy decisions. "If the thesis is correct," they write in Behavioral and Brain Sciences, "then infectious disease-related interventions are likely to have more far-reaching social, economic, and political implications. It is well known that societal choices can affect susceptibilities to infectious disease, but few have imagined a proximate causal pathway through which infectious disease can shape socio-political choices. At the start of this book, I warned that we may have less control over our minds than we think, that we may fancy ourselves in the driver's seat, but unbeknownst to us, an invisible passenger may be steering our choices and behaviors. Indeed, there may be many invisible passengers vying to steer us, perhaps even all at once. Meanwhile, as we roll along, we see road signs warning of dangers ahead. From one moment to the next, your behavioral immune system is warily assessing others, deciding whether you should be warm and friendly, maybe even have sex, or if you should adopt a chillier stance. Interactions that, when repeated over the ages and across the world, may even have shaped the cultures that make up human society. The mother of all manipulators, the boss of all bosses, is DNA, the most prolific replicator of all. It's infected every creature on the planet, forcing a long parade of hosts to devote their entire lives to furthering its transmission. Certainly, genes can goad members of our own species into doing awfully foolish things, like swooning over people who treat them badly, overeating because they evolved in a world of scarcity, or, especially in an era before birth control, having babies at all the wrong times in life. This odyssey into the hearts and minds of parasites and their hosts has taken us from genes to geopolitics. Quite a leap. But the journey, for all we know, may not end there. Maybe we ourselves are organisms inside some cosmic superbeast. What we call the universe is nothing more than a bubble of flatulence in its monstrous, gurgling gut, and we can no more comprehend its complexity and purpose than E. coli could imagine what makes a human tick, or fathom the vast expanse of time that separates its lifespan from our own. Perhaps I am getting a wee bit carried away here. My mind is exploding with thoughts of parasites. For all I know, they may even be ensconced in my brain, quietly nibbling away at my sanity. Nature is full of ghastly and glorious surprises. Not that long ago, many would have scoffed at the notion that microbes in the dark, smelly cavities of the body could influence our behavior. And few could have foreseen that a single-celled parasite would have the wherewithal to trick a rat into courting a cat. To a man with only a hammer, goes the saying, everything looks like a nail. This book presents an unabashedly parasite-centric view of the world. I have filtered the vast sweep of evolution and history through that narrow lens. Though I've tried to be impartial, I'll admit to being in awe of parasites, so it's possible that I may have on occasion given them more credit than their due. Certainly, they've been badly slighted in the past, and their abilities are still grossly underappreciated, especially their remarkable powers of mind control and the multiple pathways by which they influence both human and animal behavior. This science is still young and fluid, but developments in the field have brought us to an exciting place. For by acknowledging and examining parasites' power over us, we are certain to enhance our own power. Consider where answers to these questions might take us. If parasites are contributing to mental illness or traffic accidents, how can we evict them from our brains or otherwise thwart them? If microbes in our gut can boost our moods and lower our anxiety levels, how can we better harness them? If our fear of contagion is behind culture wars and even real wars, isn't that important to know? We alone among animals are not driven solely by instinct. We can question how the world works and use that knowledge to create powerful medicines and other wonders. We can question our values, and if we find them lacking, we can endeavor to swim against the current. Perhaps prejudice will subside as more folks grow distrustful of their moral intuitions and rely on them less often. Perhaps people will start taking probiotics instead of Prozac. It's hard to predict the future. Only this much is certain. Parasites are woven into our psychology and the very fabric of our being. Indeed, we are more microbe than human. We can be confident that this radical new vision of ourselves will open a world of fresh opportunities. This has been an Audible Studios production of This Is Your Brain on Parasites, How Tiny Creatures Manipulate Our Behavior and Shape Society. Written by Kathleen McAuliffe. Performed by Nicole Zanzarella. Producer Mike Charzik. Copyright 2016 Kathleen McAuliffe. Production copyright 2016 by Audible Inc. Audible Studios is a division of Audible Inc. Audible.